in the spirit of fashion excellence, turn to the people to your left, your right, in front of you, behind you, look them in the eye and say, looking good. Now, how many of you couldn't say that without laughing? You'd say that with a straight face. That was hard, yeah? All right. Now that we got our faith on, let's get our brain juices flowing. Let's do some warm-up. Here's your warm-up question for this morning. The question is, well, how can you tell? How can you tell? You know, how can you tell someone is looking good? How can you tell someone is good? How can you tell? How can you tell if someone is in the pocket? Think about it for 8 seconds and let me know. How can you tell? How can you tell anything? All right, what are your answers? How can you tell? Yes, Beth. You have to ask. You have to ask. Seek data. All right, what else? Yes. Look at the fruit, little Miss Bible. She read ahead. Vern?
You have to make a decision. Like, you take the input and then decide, is that good or is that bad?
Oh, so that's interesting. Vern says you have to make a decision, which is a way of saying, well, you actually have to think about it, right? You can't just sort of go off of some sort of vague, impression-y sort of something. Yeah, Steve? Sometimes you just can. There's a radiation from the person. There's a feeling. There's a sense. That's so interesting. Your wife says data, and you say impression. I say that's interesting because if you know them, it's exactly the opposite. He's the science teacher. That's amazing. I don't know what Blue Water's doing to you guys, but... Something's going on there. All right, these are good answers. Who's got another couple? How can you tell? How can you tell? Yeah, right.
They took a shower.
There is sensory input, is what Ryan is saying. I like that. Yeah, Gabe. Flip a coin. There you go. Good millennial faith. I like it. Yeah, Elena. In your spirit, some discernment. There you go. One of our youngsters being spiritual, finally, someone. Discernment, and that's a powerful word that you'd want to unpack a little bit, right? Discernment. How do you discern? How do you tell? Yes, hot Chinese chick in the back.
Because it tastes amazing.
Anna Roberts made some muffin. Well, there you go. I can tell from here. If Anna bakes, you want to get in on that. That's the rule. So you can just tell because it comes from Anna. Yeah, it's great. And William has the best and the last answer. What you got? No pressure, dude.
They're fatter than the last time you saw them.
Because they're fatter than the last time you saw them. Good input. They're getting good input. They're looking healthy. Things are going well. Things are going well for them. Yeah, all right, good. We're when the sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount, and one of his core teachings in the Sermon on the Mount is that, well, you don't judge people in the sense that you don't reject them, but, you know, we're constantly evaluating how people are doing, whether they're good, whether they're bad, whether they're helpful, trustworthy or not. And that's just part of going through life. And the more you expose your life to people, the more you get involved with people, the more discerning you have to get, right? You have to be able to read people and work with them. And it's just, I mean, so much of life is just that. Am I right? Just sort of relating to people in a wise and sensitive way. And a lot of spiritual life together, a lot of community life is about that. And so, of course, you know, Jesus continues on this theme in the Sermon on the Mount because he's trying to set his followers up for life, a capital L life, abundant life, spiritual life, and true life.
the sort that we are supposed to find in spiritual communities like the one that we share at Blue Water. If you have been around churches for any length of time, like how many of you have been around churches? You've been in church life for, say, 20 years or more. So a fair number of people, half of our folks. Here's a promise that I can make to you. You have been blessed by your involvement with the community of Christ. Am I right?
Amen.
And somebody in that time has really hurt you.
Amen.
Really screwed you over. Am I right? And when I talk to people about their involvement with church and their interest in Jesus, which I do frequently, occupational hazard, people who are not in church or not interested in Jesus, I would say probably 75% of the time say to me, like, well, you know, yeah, I had some church experience or some experience with Christians, but they ended up being what? Bad. They were hypocrite. They were fake. They were not loving. They were judgmental. But they had a bad experience with some sort of Christian leader. And, you know, I'm in no exception. I've known a lot of excellent Christian leaders. And I've known some dweebs, which is the Greek word for problematic. Problematic, the Greek word. Dweeba. Dweeba. Yeah, there you go. There was a time in my life, when I was a young adult, young 20s, I going through a very difficult time in life, a lot of really sad things that just happened to me all at once, just for like a number of years. I felt like I was being tumbled in the surf, you know, one of those seasons of life. And I got to know two professional pastors at sort of the same time. One was this very charismatic guy. He ended up being, he was just a little bit older than we were, me and Sonia, ended up being super successful. Became sort of the darling of the church movement that we were involved in. We sort of helped build a church together, and it was going fantastically well. And then I just started getting a bad feeling, you know, like I was in a bad way, but even, you know, in the midst of my own weakness, I could say, there's something funny here. And then other people sort of in the larger church community started coming to me and Sonia and said, is there something funny going on here? It was just sort of that vague spiritual discernment. And I started asking some questions and trying to recruit some help into the situation. Did not go well. We ended up getting kicked out of the church movement instead because of our complaint. I'm condensing the story mightily, as you might expect. Several years later, it all came out. And he became this very divisive, polarizing figure, ended up wounding just masses of people, very, very controlling and manipulative, and so now he's on the outs. At the same time, this is why I was thinking of that episode this week, at the same time, Sony and I, the same era of life, Sony and I had befriended this other guy. We got to know him in seminary. He quickly went out to pastor his own church in a more mainstream church movement, was never really successful. Never built a church, just sort of inherited a church and managed to dwindle it, but was faithful all this time. Like for decades, he was faithful. We've kept track of him. Nothing about his situation or his leadership would impress you. In fact, it impressed no one through his whole vocational life. So I'm thinking of it. The one guy, super impressive, super popular, super successful, I didn't trust. The other guy, not successful, not particularly charismatic, not drawing anyone, no immediate fruit, I would trust with my life to this day. You got any situations like that? People that just don't appear all that much, but that you would trust with your life. It's like, yeah. But he, she is good. How can you tell? Well,
And that's kind of what Jesus is talking about here as we begin the very final strides in the Sermon on the Mount. He's wrapping it up. It'll just be this week, and next week will be our last Sermon on the Mount sermon. I want to read today from Matthew 7. I'm just going to read a handful of verses from Matthew 7, 15 through 20. And it's the passage that Mia foreshadowed in her comments about judging a tree by its fruit. Now, what's happening in the Sermon on the Mount, the arc of it, if you have not been with us, is that Jesus begins the Sermon on the Mount talking to just a wretched crowd, a crowd of rabble. They're just very mixed, a lot of people in pain. Most of them would have been unbelievably poor. It was ethnically mixed. And people that were not religiously respectable, not spiritually respectable. And Jesus looks across the crowd and then, like, for a whole chapter, just affirms them and says, well, you guys are blessed. Blessed are you when you're down and out. Blessed are you when you're depressed. Blessed are you when people think little of you. Blessed are you when people persecute you, reject you, or disrespect you for no reason. That's kind of how it starts. And then he accelerates from there and he says, you're the light of the world. You're the salt of the earth, you know? The salt loses its saltiness, it's pointless, but you guys aren't going to do that, right? And it's just incredibly affirming. Here, toward the end of the Sermon on the Mount, he's becoming a bit more sobering. He says, look, you don't judge unless you want to be judged. He says, the gate to life is narrow and it's hard to find. The gate that leads to destruction is broad, and that's where most people go. So you all have to learn to never follow the crowd. You know, that's a big one. But this is going to take some work, I want you to know, which is a little bit more sobering in the advice. And then, of course, he ends the sermon series, which was a sermon, a passage already talked about several weeks ago by Melanie. It's like, if you follow my commands and you're like a smart person who builds a house on rock, you'll do fine. But if you don't adhere to what I say, your life is going to end with a great crash. As soon as the storm comes, you're going to fail. So he's starting to sound a little sober and consequential as he ends. So in that spirit, this is the passage that he tells us about discerning people, essentially. He says, beginning on verse 15, you can follow along on the big board. Watch out for false prophets. You guys know what a prophet is? A representative of the Lord, a minister of the Lord. Prophets were a big deal in ancient Israel. So he's talking about real spiritual leaders, spiritual influencers. See, I know the lingo. Watch out for untrustworthy influencers. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. Wolves in sheep's clothing. That's a phrase that is popular in our culture. Jesus invented it. It's one of those many, many phrases, those many, many one-liners from the Sermon on the Mount that people quote, not even knowing they're quoting Jesus. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes? I'm just checking to make sure that we know that's not where grapes come from. No. Or figs from thistles? No. Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. By their fruit, you'll recognize prophets. You'll recognize trustworthy leaders or untrustworthy leaders, influencers, as the case may be. By their fruit. Again, prophets were a big deal in Israel. There had not been a recognized prophet in Israel for 400 years, we're told. Bible doesn't say that's true, but at least no famous ones that have come down to us through history. So there was a dearth of powerful spiritual leadership in the land for a long, long, long time. And what was happening is that Jesus showed up and he was doing some interesting stuff such that people would follow him out to the countryside for healing and deliverance, and then he would give them sermons like the Sermon on the Mount. There's a buzz around Jesus at this point in his ministry. It's like, could this guy be a prophet? Could he be one of the greats? They were starting to think of him like that. And so I think that probably had something to do with why he stood up and said this. Plus, the religious authorities of the day were being very critical of him, right? There was some power plays and some jealousy. So that's the context in which Jesus is speaking. Now, they're starting to talk about him as if he may be one of the great prophets. The crowds are. But instead of hyping that, instead of like speaking to it directly, like, hey, yeah, you can trust me. Instead, he says this, which is, let me tell you how you can tell. Instead, he gives this functional teaching, which is very interesting, very Jesus. Why does he put it this way? Why does he stress that? Look, the only way to tell for sure is you judge a tree by its fruit. You have to look at the, it's another word for fruit. Results. The outcome, something like that. We'll talk about that more in a second. Why would he say that? Well, one of the reasons I think he's pausing to give this teaching is because he's foreshadowing how things will go for him. Like the crowds are following him right now and they find him helpful and impressive. Will they follow him for long? Not very long. In fact, even his closest followers would abandon him once he reached Jerusalem. And there he was killed in the most humiliating way you can possibly imagine. And even when he was resurrected, the church in Jerusalem, when he left, numbered fewer than the number of people in this room. So he would not, in this instance, he looked a little impressive. He was doing great things, but he would not seem successful for very long. And so I think this is a nice piece of wisdom for him to give the people who were like the proto-Christians. He would say, be careful how the trappings of success or celebrity influence you. Like if you judge me like you tend to judge leaders, you'll totally miss it. You'll totally miss my truth, my trustworthiness, my prophecy, my reality. So I think that's part of it. But then the passage suggests a couple of questions, just operational questions that are probably worth thinking about. And the first question might be obvious to you. What's one way to not identify a trustworthy prophet? How should you not do it? You're thinking, is this gal... all that, like, is this true? Is this helpful? Is this real? Is this life-giving? How would you not judge them, Robin? By how popular they are. Yeah, Andrew.
Blindly.
You would not do it blindly, meaning that you'd have to think about it more carefully. You wouldn't do it just reactively. Sure. What else? Yeah, Laura. You should not judge them by their proximity to power. Yeah, it was super interesting, yeah? And I think you mean proximity to like worldly power or accepted power or the normal channels of power. That's interesting, yeah. Good, what else? By their personality. Was that directed at me? By the way that they relate necessarily. I mean, somebody could have just a manifestly evil personality, I guess, and that would tip you off. But by their smiley personality. Yeah. Elena, go ahead. Their looks. You would not judge them by their looks. Yeah, Jason.
Somebody that only gives what they want.
Beware somebody who only gives them what people want. Yeah, we could go on. A word that I think, as you all give me these great answers, is that you don't judge people by their appearances or by their immediate circumstances, right? At least that's not how you judge their trustworthiness. You can't trust their appearances. You can't trust impressions. You can't trust feelings or how they make you feel emotionally in the moment or what they pander to. you probably can't trust their declarations, right? Necessarily what they say. Talk is cheap, right? And so messaging shouldn't be that influential. You can't trust their immediate circumstances, their proximity to power, how successful. You have to think about it, in other words. All right, what's the proper way to identify a trustworthy prophet? What's the proper way to go about it?
How they live their life.
How they live their life. That's interesting because you want to unpack it a little bit. Like, yeah, you'd evaluate how they live their life according to which metrics, and then that would be an interesting conversation. Andrew, got another one? Their track record, what they've done in the past, what they've achieved, perhaps, something like that. Yeah, what else? You test it against Scripture. Scripture is a good test on them, but it's also a good test for you to think if you're thinking squarely about the way that you're trusting people and the way that you're treating people. That's great. Yeah. Any others? Does their walk match their talk, right? Which is a great phrase that kind of speaks of integrity, stuff like that. Yeah, in the back? By their kindness to others, which is a super provocative response. I like that a lot because on the one hand, you want them to be kind. On the other hand, how deep does their kindness go, right? Do they say the right things or do they actually do the right things? Are they producing better circumstances in the world? Vern, got last one. What you got? How much are they giving to others as opposed to how much are they taking from others, which is both elementary and brilliant, right? Because the basic things are sort of the best things. Yeah, you know, we want to evaluate people according to their results or according to their production. What do they produce in the world around them? But specifically, we want to look at results that count, right? Because you can produce impressive results in the world that really don't count for much in the end. Or you can produce results in the world that really count forever. And you have to think about that, right? There's no real shortcut. Over time, you can develop a good instinct for it, but it begs the question, what really counts? You have to figure out what really counts with people. And I can tell from your answers that you have at least some good instincts about that. Jesus here switches, as he often does, to an agricultural metaphor when he's talking about this. Look, somebody comes to you and they seem kind of like powerful or important or spiritual or something like that. Beware! Sometimes they just look good, but on the inside, they're just manipulators, right? They're just in it for themselves. They want to devour you. This is how you do it. You judge a tree by its fruit. Now, they were in an agricultural society. They were all around farms and stuff like that, so they would have immediately understood this. Yes, that's how you judge a tree. Now, for most of you guys, you do not judge trees according to their fruit, right? How do you judge trees? According to their appearance, whether they're beautiful, according to their stature. Oh, that's so big. Every time somebody visits us from the mainland and we drive them around, what is that tree? Well, that's a banyan tree. It's so big, so wide, you know. It's very impressive. By the leaves, you know, oh, those are such healthy leaves. That tree must be an awesome tree. But if you live at subsistence level, you only judge a tree according to whether or not it produces fruit, whether it produces food, right? And so this is something that they would understand immediately and intimately in this crowd. If the tree on the farm has a magnificent stature, if it looks beautiful, if it's got the healthiest, thickest, most robust leaves in the world, and that sucker doesn't produce any fruit, you don't have time or space for that tree. You cut it down and it becomes firewood today, right? That's the idea. So fruit is a loaded concept for them. I don't think it's as intuitive for us as we read the passage, but they would have understood it. Does it support life or not? Does it support life or does it support excitement, you know, impressiveness, you know, popularity, success? There's a difference. That's what Jesus means when he talks about fruit. In fact, there's another famous story about a tree. When Jesus is entering Jerusalem, he passes a fig tree that has beautiful leaves, but it's not producing any figs. And Jesus curses the tree, and it dies. Because basically he's saying, I don't care how impressive you look. I don't care how popular you are. If you're not producing what counts to really give people life, then you're dead. And he was very ornery that day. He was mad about the Jewish religious leaders, actually, the state of the temple. And so he went off on that tree, and the tree was no more. So good fruit is something like, I don't know, like life-sustaining nourishment. And then bad fruit would be absolutely anything else. That's not that. And I can't help but think about his statement earlier in the Sermon on the Mount about salt that loses its saltiness. Like, you have to really understand what the point is. You have to understand what the point of life is, and you have to understand what the point of people is. And most people don't. I don't think in our world people judge other people appropriately at all. I think we're probably far worse at it today than they were back then, actually, because we've become detached from stuff that counts a lot because our society is so easy compared to their society, and we've become image manipulators. So I don't think we think a lot about fruit. I don't think we're hungry enough. We're cushioned enough in life that we're not hungry for life like people used to be. So that's a disadvantage we have. I think in our culture, people tend to evaluate their profits according to their celebrity. I think if somebody gets famous, they are automatically trusted in our society. And I think that's heinous. I think that's outright satanic. I could go off on that a lot. As you can tell, I have very strong feelings about this, about people who get trusted in society and why they get trusted in society. More broadly, I think particularly these days, in the last five or six years or so, I think people have developed a template for what a prophet, for what a leader, a spiritual leader, a cultural leader should look like. I think less and less it's about what people have done and more about whether or not they fit your template. I think we hardly care at all about what people have done anymore. I could go off a long time about politics today, but I don't think we give a whit about what people have done. I think we only care about whether they fit a particular template. And that's a recipe for death. I mean, that's never going to go well. And I think we've committed our culture to it wholesale. I think we've invented new phrases to describe it over the past 5 years. I'm just amazed. I'm aghast at where our culture is headed in this regard. You know, I'll stop that now. Where do we find our prophets today as a culture? And I think even as a church sometimes, I think the world's religion is politics, and I think the world's religion is culture, which includes entertainment and media. I think that's where we find our prophets by and large. These are not going to be true prophets, right? Almost all of these are going to be false prophets, but I think the world is just rushing to them. But as bad as that is, and I really do think it's nasty, but as bad as that is, the thing that concerns me most today is not how people or believers might mistrust false prophets. What concerns me most today is the way that I think people and believers no longer recognize true prophets. That's what bothers me most. I think that a true prophet could walk in to most don't know, pick an institution, most government gatherings, most universities, a lot of churches, and be completely unrecognized. Because people don't know what to look for. They've kind of lost the idea of what's fruit and what's life-giving. They don't think very far at all. They just kind of react, you know, and I think that is super dangerous. And more than that, and I'm not going to talk very much about this, I think God is raising up today. I found this very entertaining, actually. I think in, around the world today, the Lord has raised up quite a number of true prophetic voices. But they don't look right. And I think people are not recognizing them for what they are. And I think I mostly am, but even my response is like, I don't even like these people. But dang, I see what God's doing with them. Some of these people, don't let me shock you, not even Christians, but they're truth seekers in an incredible way. And it's caused them to have to act bravely and fearlessly. And the Lord is giving them platforms. I'm thinking to myself, that platform should have gone to a veteran believer. But the Lord is like, shh, they're mine. I'm doing what I'm doing. And I think even large tracts of the church are like, well, what? Not the right template, not the right template. And being very critical and rejectionary and judgmental. And I'm thinking, look at the fruit, man. Look at the fruit. These voices are showing people how to cut through the worldly BS and to find Jesus. And some of them are coming to Jesus right before our eyes in very public ways. And I'm like, I told ya. You know, it's like, finally, I get one right. Doesn't happen a lot. And the reason I give you that very vague description of what I think is going on today is because of this. The Lord always raises up prophets. The Lord always raises up light, right? The Lord always raises up salty people. Always, you know. The Lord isn't much bothered by what happens in the world. He's been doing this a long time. But the people he raises up, and Jesus taught us this, are not necessarily impressive. They're not like, they don't appear in a way that would help you identify them. You would have to think and consider results and fruitfulness, and maybe get over your templates, and maybe get over yourself, and maybe just kind of ask the Lord what's going on. Because a lot of us are lost in the wilderness today. And the Lord always raises up a signpost. I say this often these days, and I will say it till the day I die. The world is a lying cult trying to control you. The world is a lying cult trying to control you. And the world tells you that the reason it's trying to control you is for your own good. It's for your own good. But you know what that is? That's a wolf in sheep's clothing is what that is. All the time. You know, our political sphere is filled with wolves in sheep clothing. Our cultural sphere is filled with wolves in sheep clothing. There's very little distinction between the political and the cultural anymore. Our media sphere, oh my gosh, don't even get me started on that. And even in our church, you find wolves in sheep clothing. But in the church, we're used to seeing it and ferreting them out. That's why if you've been in the church for 20 years or more, you've had this experience. And a lot of people reject the church for that reason. But they don't reject the world, which just tells you how deceived they are. Because the church at least has some true prophets in it. You know. Two comments to end the sermon now that I've stirred the pot. One, I know the best way to identify the true prophet. I know the best way to identify the trustworthy person. I've figured this out. Well, okay, I had a little help from Jesus, but I figured it out, and some of the comments that we've heard already today anticipate the answer. The best way to determine whether any influencer is trustworthy is to gauge whether or not you see self-sacrifice in them.
Amen.
Did they sacrifice themselves? Did they die to life in order to find a better life? That, of course, is why we know that Jesus is the most trustworthy prophet of all. He said, lest a seed fall to the ground and die, it remains alone. But if a seed falls to the ground and dies, if it sacrifices its life, then it will produce a rich harvest, right? You need to sacrifice yourself if you want to be a true prophet. You need to sacrifice yourself. You need to give up more than you take in. Yeah. Elementary and brilliant. Do you see self-sacrifice in the champions you've chosen to honor? If not, back the heck up. Back the heck up. And, you know, that goes for the church world. That goes for the world. No one is perfect, you know, but look for that. Look for that. It's the tried and true standard. And I told a story earlier about that experience I had with these two professional pastors. And, you know, I've been thinking about it a long time, like this idea of trustworthiness. You would think that I would go through experiences like that, and the result for me would be, now I know how to tell a trustworthy person from an untrustworthy person. And like I said, I think I do know, right? You look for self-sacrifice. You look for someone who's willing to give stuff up. But the result of these experiences, the result for me of my experiences of untrustworthy leadership, untrustworthy influencers, is actually more self-reflective. It has, over the years, forced me to ask myself, well, what do I want to be like then? Which I think is another reason that Jesus gives this teaching. You don't want to be a wolf in sheep's clothing. You don't want to be a false sheep. That's actually what we're going to talk about next week. It's the final little chunk of the Sermon on the Mount. You don't want to be false in any way. And here's the reason I've come to that conclusion for my own life. It's not because I just love integrity so much and I'm such a great person that I want to be loving and self-sacrificial. It's because I've noticed, see if you can follow me here, that for true prophets, for true spiritual ministers, for true spiritual leaders, even when they're not successful, they're still fruitful. You following me? Like, even their failures end up having good effects in the world. And I like that a lot, because it means I can be a total failure and still produce good fruit. Because it comes from a good place inside me, you know, because I'm not being false about it. I fail a lot. I bet I failed more grandly, more often than any of you, which is a heck of a boast. I don't have a lot to boast about, but that might be one thing. And of course, I hate failure. I hate when I fail. But God has a way of redeeming that. God has a way of redeeming when I don't look impressive, but I'm nonetheless true. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Are you feeling it? Are you following me? God has a way of redeeming when I look unimpressive, when I feel unimpressive, when I perform unimpressively, but truly, honestly, self-sacrificially, as long as I'm self-sacrificial, loving. And that's what happened for Jesus, right? He was self-sacrificial to the end. His movement failed. stopped dead in its tracks. And then a short while later went on to change the entire globe.
Amen.
Right? So even your failures are redeemed, prophetically speaking. All right. Have I dwelled on that enough? So maybe that's security for you guys, right? Maybe you're like, well, I want to be true then. You know, I want to be self-sacrificial. I want to focus on the fruit rather than the success, if that makes sense. I want to focus on the results rather than the wins and losses. Because even a loss can produce great results in the world. There was this Netflix documentary series. I don't know if it's still up, on losers. It was a great title. I had to watch it. And it was about people who lost everything in life and what happened to them after that, which I think is great. Jesus says famously, he who loses his life will find it. Yeah, provided you're true. All right, we'll stop there today. It's a sobering teaching, but I hope that in a roundabout sort of way, it's also a comforting teaching for you. It's worth being true, even if you're not successful. And it's worth pursuing self-sacrificial truth and integrity. Service, giving your life away, even if it makes you feel small and unimpressive. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit. There's an embedded promise in this passage. A bad tree cannot produce good fruit. No matter how successful you are, no matter how celebrated you are, if you're a bad tree, your results are not going to be positive. However, no matter how wretched you look, no matter how meager your life, no matter how bare your branches, if you're a good tree, you cannot produce bad results. What he says. Do you like that?
Yes.
You want to be good trees?
Yes.
Turn to somebody at your left or right and say, you're a good tree.
You're a good tree.